Okay, well, I think I'm gonna maybe read a couple verses and just share a few thoughts that've been on my mind the last week or so, a few of them at least. And I'm gonna start by just reading a few verses from Luke chapter 19, starting verse 1. It says, "Then Jesus entered and passed through Jericho, and behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. He sought to see Jesus, to see who Jesus was, but could not because of the crowd, for he was of short stature. So he ran ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was going to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said to him, 'Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must stay at your house.' So he made haste and came down and received him joyfully. But when they saw it, they all complained, saying, 'He has gone to be a guest with a man who is a sinner.' Then Jesus stood and said to the Lord, 'Look, Lord, I give half of my goods to the poor. And if I have taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold.' And Jesus said to him, 'Today salvation has come to this house, because he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost.'" I'm not sure exactly how to describe this, but especially that very last sentence, where it says, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost," kind of felt really powerful and encouraging to me recently. I'm not sure how to put it into words, but just kind of the I've been thinking about the way that the scriptures speak of Jesus as the perfect representation of the Father, like the visible image of the invisible God. Or like it says in the very beginning of Hebrews, God spoke for thousands of years in various ways through the prophets and different means, but in this last day he's spoken to us kind of perfectly. That I'm adding a few words, but like in his Son, the culmination like of revelation, there was obviously like a revealing of the Father throughout the whole Old Testament, but nothing compared to the clarity and the revelation and I don't know how to say it, the what was communicated when Jesus Christ took up a body and walked on the earth and manifested his Father. And so he's able to say to his disciples before he dies, he says, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. You don't have to say, 'Show us the Father.'" Remember that passage? Have I been with you so long and you've not understood this? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And some of like that reality, kind of holding on to that reality at the same time as like reading this little vignette about Zacchaeus and just kind of seeing and understanding that this thing that Jesus was doing was the manifestation of the Father's heart, was the unveiling of the eternal, invisible God. That the heart of God, the heart of the Father, was to seek and to save that which was lost. And Jesus did so many things that kind of manifested this and represented it. And, Zacchaeus was this tax collector, and there's this moment in the story, and there's these sort of things pop up all over the place in the Gospels where the people are offended at him. And they don't like the fact that he has gone to be a guest with this man who is a sinner. You know, like other places, if he knew who was touching him, if he knew that this woman was a sinner, he wouldn't let her do this. Why is he doing this? And the sort of religious Jews especially were they misunderstood him and they were offended at him. They complained and said he has gone to be a guest with a man who is sinner, a sinner. But something amazing was happening, which is this sinner, this Zacchaeus, this lost sheep of the Father was returning, was turning around, was saying to himself, kind of in the language of the prodigal son, he was saying, "I will arise and go to my father." And that is like that rejoiced the heart of the Father. That was the very thing for which Jesus came to do. That was He was always and constantly manifesting a desire to seek and to save. And so he rebukes his disciples in another place and says, when they say, "Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven?" He says, you don't understand the spirit from which you are speaking." And I think they also misunderstood the Old Testament story. Of course, like he wasn't denying, and I'm not denying that the story about Elijah and those 50s, you know, happened, but they had misunderstood. And he says, "You don't know what spirit you are of, because I didn't come to destroy men's lives, but to save." I forget how he says it in that passage exactly. "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." And it's interesting, like just last night, Harriet was asking me about kind of the revelation of God in the Old Testament. And my thoughts have kind of been on that a little bit because I like it's easy, and some people have said over, you know, men and women have said that it almost you can look at it in one way and say that like the Old Testament reveals like a different God, or you can say, some people might say, "I don't like the God of the Old Testament." But the God of the New Testament is it seems great. And that's not what Harriet was saying, but she was just kind of asking about why. Not exactly what you're saying. She was saying like it's a little yeah, there's some strange imagery and figures, and there's some things in the Old Testament that are more difficult to relate to. And then you see sort of like Jesus, and I totally understand that. I think that there is I would absolutely say that I think it is perfectly consistent. But there's such a greater unveiling of there's such a greater clarity. Like what there's a verse I think where Paul says that like life and immortality are brought to light in the gospel. Like things that were kind of a mystery and were veiled in shadows that were always there, and you could sort of see the them sort of peeking out from the shadows here and there all throughout the Old Testament. It's like you could see the sort of light of like the real light of the heart of the Father sort of shining out through little cracks and all the types and shadows throughout the Old Testament. It was always there, but then it just kind of like the whole thing gets uncovered, and there's this like pure and strong and bright and clear revealing of who the Father is and what his heart is. And I think it's then it's easier, and we're in this, you know, great position to then be able to like look back at the Old Testament and kind of say, "Ah, you were there the whole time. Like it was always you behind those shadows and all and behind all the stories and the figures." And I don't claim to perfectly understand why he manifested himself in certain ways, or why he used all the imagery or all the language throughout all the old covenant, but I'm sure it's in great wisdom. And I'm not in, I'm not sure how he maybe could have even done it better or done it in a different way, but that's sort of I don't know. It's useless for me to speculate about that. I have no ability, but it's felt a little bit like warm and living and encouraging to me to kind of feel and know and think about the heart of the Father from the foundation of the world, and not just kind of as an abstract thing. It is a it's I don't know that it is abstract in any way, but also in how it touches how we think about these lives, how we think about these days and months and years and decades that we're passing through. Because if I think if we kind of know a little bit what the Father is doing and what he's desiring to do, then we can stop fighting against him and accept and work with him during the time of our stay here on the earth. One of the verses that also has popped in my mind a decent amount is from I love this verse from 2 Samuel 14. I've brought it up a couple times over the years. This to me feels like one of those little spots where like the Father's heart sort of breaks through the cracks. It has to do with the Joab sort of interceding for the return of Absalom to David. And the whole context of the story isn't like critical at the moment, but just these couple sentences that this woman says to King David, where she's essentially trying to convince David to bring back Absalom, and Absalom has been banished for his sin. Like Absalom was not a good guy. You know, he had been sent out from the presence of the Lord, or sorry, from the presence of David. And this woman speaking to David says, this is Second Samuel 14:14. For we will surely die and become like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away a life, but he devises means. But he devises means so that his banished ones are not expelled from him. But God does not take away a life, but devises means so that his banished ones are not expelled from him. That's all. I don't think you could almost, you know, put together a few words to kind of describe better what Jesus manifested during the whole course of his life and ministry and parables and teaching. Is a desire to seek and to save that which is lost. And I love the I love that phrase. He devises means. Like he's thinking, he's planning, he's plotting, wanting his banished ones to return, because that phrase, like his banished ones, I feel like that sort of perfectly describes the state. I mean, that is the state of man. It was never meant to be that way. Like man was created for man was created to be at home with the Father forever in his presence, and yet because of sin and self and the fall, they were literally cast out, literally banished from his presence, sent out of the garden. But never like never was the heart of God lost, or of course that doesn't even make sense, but like even in his banishing of them, he had to banish them. They had done something and made themselves something that made fellowship with him impossible. He hadn't changed at all, but they had done something that had broken that fellowship and had made them, they'd banished themselves. But you can see from the very beginning that the Father is pursuing them. And the Father begins to speak of a bruiser of the serpent, a seed of a woman. And immediately, the first generation of humans living in this fallen world, inheriting this nature from their parents who had been banished from the garden, like immediately he begins striving and wrestling with them and speaking to them and saying, "Sin is crouching at your door, warning," like what he does with Abel, sorry, Cain. We see kind of this perfect picture in Cain and Abel of one son returning to the father and one son not returning to the father. But the father seeks this, the father desires to seek and save that which is lost. And so he speaks to Cain. He pleads with him, I think you could say. He reveals himself to him. He says, "It doesn't have to be this way. Why is your countenance fallen? Like, will you not be accepted if you do what is right? Let me warn you about something. Let me tell you something. There's something called sin, and it's crouching at your door, and it wants to devour you. It's going to devour you if you let it." And so from the very beginning, he's been seeking to bring back his banished ones, his prodigals. And that's just been his desire, I think, from the very beginning. And I think one of the things that can make maybe the Old Testament or just God in general like a little bit confusing is that he is willing to use pain and suffering. Always in service of a greater good, and always in service of preventing more pain. But he's such a good father, he's such a good physician that he will not withhold means that are painful. He devises means to bring his banished ones home. And I feel really convinced that in his love and his goodness, he is always trying to use the means that will cause the least amount of suffering to his children. I think that's just kind of almost a self-evident truth. If he is good, if he has an eternal will to all goodness, to every creature that he has created, how could he possibly do anything else than will the least amount of suffering for his creatures? And yet, he's willing to wound, he's willing to hurt, he's willing to tear down, he's willing to be like a lion to Israel. There's like language in the prophets like that. "I'm going to be like a lion. I'm going to tear you and devour you and go away. But then I'm going to heal you." Another verse that has been on my mind, that kind of along these lines, comes from Isaiah chapter 8. It says, Isaiah chapter 8, I'll start in verse 5. "And the Lord also spoke to me again, saying, 'Inasmuch as these people refused the waters of Shiloah that flow softly, and rejoice in reason and in Remaliah's son, now therefore, behold, the Lord brings up over them the waters of the river, strong and mighty, the king of Assyria in all his glory. He will go up over all his channels and go over all his banks. He will pass through Judah. He will overflow and pass over. He will reach up to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. And the thing I sort of see there, I don't claim to understand all those phrases or everything that means, but it seems clear to me that here we have sort of a picture of kind of means, two different means, and the Lord making it, or you could say, like in this case, two different rivers. And the Lord first offered them the waters of Shiloah that flowed softly, but the people refused it. And as much as these people refused the waters of Shiloah that flow softly, and rejoiced in reason in Remaliah's son. I think that those are some sort of like contemporary like political figures, I think, that they were trusting in and leaning on instead of yielding to the work and the judgment and the callings and the pleadings and the invitations of the Father. That's what I feel in that phrase of these gently flowing waters that God offered them first. There was something there of the Father. There was a means that he had devised to bring them back, and he had devised a softly flowing river that they could have yielded to. They didn't have to refuse it, and he tried that first with them, but they refused it. And so it's because of that that he brings up this strong and mighty flood of another river, and that flood is the nation of Assyria, and that's this picture and this reality of one of the many places in the Old Testament where great and painful and sorrowful and seemingly harsh judgments overtakes Israel. But I think you just get this little, again, here's a little crack. And the Lord is kind of saying that I didn't want to send Assyria to you. I didn't want to send this raging, overflowing river and that to leave you, like to go up to your neck and almost drown you in it. I tried to send you the softly flowing rivers of Shiloh, but you didn't listen. And you can see this same heart in many, many places. You can see it in like the life of the prophet Jeremiah, who was sent by the Lord over and over to warn, to speak, like at this period of time, like right up to this very cataclysmic and painful and awful and seemingly harsh judgment of the Father. He was standing there speaking, sending prophets over and over again. They killed the prophets, and he raised up another and sent one. And Jesus talks about this pattern, like in his parables, doesn't he? Does he not? Like he talks about like it's like a vineyard, on the owner of the vineyard is far away, but he sends a servant, and they mistreat him. And so what does he do? Does he immediately, blow up the vineyard? No, he sends another one, and he sends another one, and they keep mistreating him and beating him and stoning him. And then in that parable, that's where he says, "Then I'll send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him." That kind of always gets me. Sorry. Like that's who does that, after they killed and mistreated and stoned and murdered servant after servant, when he would have been so justified and forsaking them forever, he says, "I know what I'll do. I'll send my beloved son." And of course, they kill him too. That's all right. I think that we can see the Father that Jesus was revealing, the one who is desiring to seek and to save the lost, the one who is made the whole world a theater, like a nursery for prodigals. Like that's how I think the father thinks of it, is time and place for people to return to him. And he's using means, and he's devising means, and he's offering us prophets, and he's speaking to us, and he's pleading with us, and he's sending softly flowing waters of Shiloh. And many of us are not listening. And so he sends us rivers, and he sends us judgments. And I think much of this is demonstrated on the pages of the Old Testament, and much of it seems kind of dark and hard or even harsh. But I think what's behind it is a love that is trying to seek and to find and to restore and to bring home his prodigals, and bring them back home, bring them back into fellowship with the Father. And I guess just that reality has been feeling really, really precious to me. And it feels to me like it gives a, how to say it, like helps me understand life and time and suffering and all the difficulties. Like I know that there's so much suffering in this world. There's so much suffering even in the lives and the hearts of people who are trying earnestly to follow him and to love him. I don't know all the stories even of the people in this room or the people who are connected online right now, but I know that we are all battling and struggling and facing hardships and difficulties and of all varieties, inward, outward. And some of you guys are going through things that almost nobody knows about, or no, almost nobody understands the intensity of them or the pain, and it can be confusing. And I think if we kind of understand this life and this world as a as time and place for banished ones to return, as time and place for prodigals to return, as a place where all of the father's children are either, to me, it seems like they're either doing one of two things. They're kind of like walking the road away from the father's house. So like I'm thinking about the parable of the prodigal son, and he, you know, first he says, give me what belongs to me. Like, give me what I can take from this world for myself. Give me what I can have of you, Father. I want what belongs to me. Split it up, divide it, give it to me. I'm out of here. I wanna it's sort of like just like in the parable I mentioned earlier, where the tenants working in the vineyard say, like, you know, this is the heir. If we kill him, the vineyard will be ours. Like wanting to take the things and the place that the Father had given them, like to themselves and for themselves, and use them for their own means. I want this vineyard to be mine. If we kill the son, it'll be mine. That's kind of like what I think the prodigal son did at first, as he said, I don't care to be with the father or in his house. I just want what he can give me, and I want to go off and I want to live. And so there's some of us and people all over the world are in that condition of trying to take from the earth, trying to take from natural life, and walking away from the Father's house. And then there are others who have said to themselves, I will arise and go to my Father. And I think about you know, I think we've frequently talked about that famine that came to the prodigal son, as is a place where William Law calls that, like he says, oh, happy famine. And he talks about that as this great blessing. And I think that's absolutely the right way to see that. That is one of the means of the Father. And it was a difficult and a painful means. And maybe there were even worse and even harder and even more difficult means behind that in his love and mercy if the prodigal hadn't responded to that. But there he sat, kind of like broken and hungry and broke, literally bankrupt and out of money and far away from the Father, hurting and lost. And there's so much of that in this world. And you could say, like, where is the Father? Where is the goodness of a God who is all good? But that is his goodness, because these are the means by which he is awakening us and seeking to reach us and being willing. Like, he's so good. He's such a good father. Like, weak and worthless fathers in the name of some sort of false love will never cause their kids any pain. But a good father will, doesn't he say it all over the scriptures? Like, I reprove and rebuke and chastise and punish and discipline and scourge the sons I love. Don't misunderstand that. So he allows kind of like the vanity and the emptiness and the pain of these lives that are mixed with misery and disappointment and difficulty to like awaken our hearts and put in us a cry that says, I will arise and go to my Father. And I think we can, I don't know, I'm always I feel like I'm always searching for some sort of grand unifying principle of all time and human experience. But I feel like this is it, if there was one. So it's like, if we could believe that this is what the Father is doing, if we could receive the pains and the difficulties and the challenges and the sorrows as these invitations to as these means by which the Father is trying to bring his banished ones home, like he and if we could really lean into them and grab them with both hands and softly accept them and begin to return to him, like he is wanting to bring us home and to restore us to a fellowship, and the angels in heaven have more joy over the one sheep that was lost than the 99. And there's, I don't know, there's no words that can kind of express the goodness of what the Father is trying to bring us to, and the fact that everything we've ever wanted is in the Father's house and is in fellowship with him. And that's the end of the story of the prodigal. It's just like so amazing the way the son comes back to the Father's house and he rejoices over him. And you can even see in that I read at the very beginning, like Zacchaeus, the story of Zacchaeus, and right there were the grumblers saying, like complaining, saying he's gone to, like, what of all the people here, why Zacchaeus's house, you know? And don't you kind of hear and feel the same thing as like the second son in the prodigal story, a prodigal son story, who just kind of he's offended at the father who seeks and saves what is lost. The fact that the father rejoices and restores and is trying to bring the father's delighted to have the prodigal back. In the same way that Jesus is delighted that Zacchaeus is a son of Abraham, and the other sons say that this isn't right, this isn't fair, which kind of tells me that like that other son, he was a prodigal in a way too, if you think about it, like I guess he didn't run off with his father's goods and waste them with prostitutes in a foreign country, but he also hadn't come to live and experience and know the Father, right? The Father deals with him too and says, "Son, I am always with you, and all that I have is yours." But I don't think that son understood that. And I guess I sort of feel in those two things, like different ways humanity goes aside. There's the prodigal who runs into the world, and worldliness, and misses the father's love and the father's house. And then there's the like religious one who thinks he knows the father and can look down and can like sneer at the tax collector, and yet has also completely missed the heart of the father and what it means to be home with the father, you know, because like he was home, but he wasn't really home. You know what I mean? He thought he was home. Anyway, it's neat to me also that it seems like the father used the returning of the prodigal from a far country to help the other son too. You know, have you ever thought about that? Like, it exposed something in that other son. And it just makes me think about, the wisdom and the goodness of God weaving everything together, every situation, weaving together the sin of other people to help you know, to expose your own heart, to bring you to where you need to be. I think that we're going to see and know one day that the invisible God has been an incredible wisdom, an incredible mercy. Working all things together for good. And I just think it's so important for us to give our hearts to him, to be willing sacrifices on that daily altar, to throw ourselves up like clay on the wheel of his forming every single day, and trust him and just say, teach me, make me, bring me home through whatever means you see fit, through the right mixture of comfort and enjoyment and peace and happiness and sorrow and difficulty and pain. Bring me home, bring me back, make me one who shares your nature, who's at home with you, who knows that I'm always with you and all that you have is mine, who comes to actually share the heart of the Father, who would never grumble and complain at the goodness and love and mercy, but comes to rejoice in the returning of every other prodigal too, you know, to pull out from us every bit of religious hypocrisy and make us soft and meek and childlike. Like him. Yeah, these months and years and decades are know, that's what I think the Lord is doing in the midst of them. And I think that the more we can kind of set our hearts to return, to kind of journey back today, to try to, yeah, to yield to the yield to every dealing and dispensation and every discipline and every loving correction, to take everything that comes with us as an aid to walking back to him. I think it would be good for us. I think it'd be good for me. I think I'm trying to slowly see that way and learn that lesson. And go end with that, and you guys can.